Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Hi, everybody. We're back with the Vox Pop with Dr. Paul Lemansky, my friend. He joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. He comes to us from the Center for Preventative Medicine and Cardiovascular Health at St. Peter's. He is the founder and director of the center. Dr. Lemansky is board certified and an internist with a master's degree in human nutrition. He's a graduate of New York Medical College. Prior to his work at the Center for Preventive Medicine, Dr. Lemansky was clinical chief for cardiovascular health for Kaiser Permanente's Northeast Division. He's currently assistant clinical professor of medicine at Albany Medical College and a fellow of the American College of Physicians. Paul, Dr. Lemansky, thank you so much for being here. People love it when you're here because you answer questions and whatever.
Absolutely.
Okay, everybody, 1-800-348-2551. By the end of this show, you're not going to be able to get in. You want to be smart. Now's the time to do it. Hey, Paul, I recently lost 12 pounds. Right. And, you know, I mean, I now have very interesting things. My sugar numbers have gone down dramatically, and other indices, which one would not have maybe expected. I always had heartburn. I have hiatal hernia. That has settled down because of the weight loss. The abdomen, it's not being pushed up by the abdomen. So losing just, you know, a certain amount of weight can be immensely helpful, can it?
Absolutely. So in individuals who are, let's say, 50 pounds above ideal body weight, the loss of 10 or 15, even 20 pounds can be dramatic in terms of lowering blood sugar, you know, in terms of, as in your case, gastroesophageal reflux was helped, in terms of cholesterol values. And, you know, this goes back to what I've been saying for a while, which is that the human body, the human machine, has tolerances built into it, very similar to the tolerances you'd see in an internal combustion engine, where thousandths of an inch can mean the difference between burning oil and not burning oil. You know, your piston has to, in your block has to move in such a way that there's very little chance for oil to leak into the system. And human body is very similar. The biochemical tolerances are such that we do not, as a species, tolerate even 10, 15, or 20 extra pounds well, and we certainly don't tolerate 50 extra pounds well. So individuals need to understand that, especially, Alan, in the case of elevated blood sugar metabolic syndrome. In an individual who's a pre-diabetic metabolic syndrome, the elevation of blood sugar, even a little bit, means that that individual is resistant to the effects of their own insulin and will respond to that by putting out additional insulin, so they become hyperinsulinemic. And when they become hyperinsulinemic, that is bought at a cost. And what I mean by that is that the cells that produce the insulin, the islet cells in the pancreas, actually work overtime. And in the process, you're maybe working these cells at 120% of capacity, they start to burn out. They die from overwork. Sounds horrible, but it's silent and true. And what happens in the long run is, an individual, by the time their blood sugar gets to be elevated fasting to 126 or above, which is the definition of diabetes mellitus, an individual has lost somewhere between 50 and 70% of the cells that produce insulin. Wow. So we need to understand this silent process. It's actually not so silent, because we can find out if our blood sugar is slightly elevated or if our abdominal circumference is too big, and especially if we're predisposed by family history to diabetes. These things can be something that our doctor can tell us. They can tell us whether we have elevated blood sugar, whether we have prediabetes or metabolic syndrome, and then the time to make the intervention is before all those islet cells have been lost.
Okay, first question for Dr. Paul Lemansky. Sharon from Saratoga Springs, is there any way to know your vascular health? 1-800-348-2551. I'm going to bet the answer is yes.
Well,
let's see. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I do think that, you know, you can get an idea about your vascular health. The first thing is, you know, we try to look at your family history to get an idea of your vascular health. So if you have a first-degree relative who had heart disease, that puts you at higher risk for vascular problems. So if you have a first-degree female relative, sister or mother, who's, you know, had a elevation of their cholesterol above a certain level, that's going to put you at risk. You know, you can tolerate some elevations in cholesterol, but if they go up too high, then, you know, the problem becomes, you know, first degree relative, for example, mother, father, sister, brother, if it's a female, if over the age of 65 puts you at risk, I'm sorry, under the age of 65 puts you at risk. If it's a male first degree relative, under the age of 55 puts you at risk. And that immediately means that your LDL cholesterol should really be under 100 milligrams per deciliter, and that is a tough goal to achieve.
But Sharon, are you there? Are you there?
Wow. Yes, I am.
Okay, but Sharon, the question I would ask Paul, you know, then is, but is there a, as Sharon may have been asking, is there a medical test? Is there a test?
Right.
Well, that's there is,
thank
and
you.
That medical test is a lipid profile, which is what I'm, the LDL cholesterol specifically, but that has to be interpreted, okay?
Right.
And family history is very important to the interpretation. You know, apart from that, there are ways of measuring the presence of plaque in arteries. There is an inflammatory measurement called a high-sensitivity CRP. That basically, in the human body, when cholesterol gets into the artery wall, the artery and the body respond with inflammation. That is the infiltration of white blood cells, those that fight infection, into the artery wall. The actual cholesterol plaque is looked at the body as a foreign substance, especially when it becomes oxidized, and therefore the white blood cells will attack it. Right? Okay. That process can be measured, that inflammatory response can be measured by this high-sensitivity CRP test.
Now, I asked my primary care about that, and she kind of poo-pooed it. Seemed like I was, like, I don't know. You know, I'm trying to address it before anything happens. I don't want to have to deal with it when it happens.
Right.
So it was almost as if she was like, you don't have anything wrong with you, so well, let's not go there. Like, maybe I was worrying or something.
Right.
I'm thinking,
well, again,
well, both my parents have high cholesterol. And
sure.
My grandmother died of heart, or maybe she didn't die from it, but she had hardening of the arteries in her neck.
Yeah, what age was that happening?
I think 60, late 50s, early 60s.
Okay, so that's a little bit concerning. So when you know that history, then you can interpret your own cholesterol profile in light of that. Your LDL should be down around 100.
Okay.
If it's not, you know, you might want to do some more, you know, dietary approaches to lower it, restriction of saturated fat. If it is, you might look at other tests like CRP, high sensitivity CRP, to see if that inflammatory marker is also within the target range. There are imaging studies that can be done. So you could do carotid ultrasound to look and see if there's plaque, evidence for plaque in the carotid arteries. There's a CAT scan that could be done of your heart. It's called, it sounds like a lot, but it is a lot in my estimation in terms of radiation exposure.
Yeah.
But, you know, in some individuals, they want to know it with no uncertain terms whether there is plaque in their arteries, and that's one way to find out.
Hey, Sharon, we got to let you go. We've got a lot of people coming up, okay?
Alan, can I ask one more quick question?
Sure, okay.
Sorry, thanks. You were expressing, Doctor, about the reading of these tests. Is this something that maybe I should just kind of bypass my primary and go see a cardiologist that I had seen once before for some chest pain?
Well, you know, I never think it's a good idea, since I am a primary, I never think it's a good idea to bypass the primary. But what I would do would be to say that you would prefer a referral to cardiology and ask the primary to send you. And then all the requisite information from the primary will go to the cardiologist, and then they'll be able to address that issue for you.
Sharon, you're
great.
Done.
Thank you. Bye.
We're going to take a short break. We will be right back. So Nancy and John will be right with you.
Support comes from Premier Medical Group, gastroenterology, urology, internal medicine, endocrinology, geriatrics, nephrology, and pulmonology, with offices throughout the Hudson Valley. PremierMedicalHV.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees. Offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. And Albany Institute of History and Art. GE presents The Mystery of the Albany Mummies. Uses ancient artifacts and modern technologies to uncover secrets of the museum's mummies. Through June 8th, albanyinstitute.org.
And we are back with my friend and a great doctor, Paul Lemanski. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Nancy in Albany. Nancy, you're on.
Yes, hi, Dr. Lemanski, Dr. Shartok. Dr. Lemanski, I am probably obsessed with cholesterol. My LDL is 73, HDL 70. I realize that our liver makes two-thirds of the cholesterol. What effect does my very healthy eating have on what's made in the cholesterol? Or in the liver. I have friends who eat fish fries and all kinds of stuff. I'm not going to change my eating habits, but what effect does what I eat have on the type of cholesterol that's made in the liver, doctor?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. And like everything else in life, you know, it's the old bell curve. For some people, it has a dramatic effect. For other people, it has very little effect. And for the average person, it has an average impact. But we think that, you know, it certainly makes sense if your cholesterol is elevated to try and use diet and exercise, lifestyle change to get it down rather than take drugs to do so. And if you can get it down within a reasonable range, that's great. If you already have heart disease, then you may have to take a drug in addition to using diet and lifestyle.
Right. Now, I did say my LDL is 73.
Yeah. Yeah, that's excellent.
Okay.
So you shouldn't obsess about it. You should feel very comfortable that your cholesterol is in a range that it's quite excellent for preventing further, you know, for preventing heart disease and for if you had any plaque, for preventing the progression of that plaque. We know that LDL around 70, the deposition of cholesterol into the artery wall stops.
The 2,000-year-old man said, never eat any fried foods. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely wrong. You can eat fried foods, but the frequency with which you eat it has to be very, very infrequent.
So you're a moderationist?
I am a moderationist.
I am not.
I know you're an
absolutist.
So there's no food that is absolutely verboten. However,
I haven't had a fish fry in about 10 years.
Well,
where I think about what it's doing to my arteries, so I'm not even attracted
exactly.
to it.
Maybe
exactly,
Dr. Chartok will take you out for one just to show that it's possible
exactly,
for him to go.
Nancy. Well done.
Yes,
well
but
said.
You won't eat it, would you, Doctor?
No. No.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr.
Sure
Lemanski and Chartok.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551, and over to John in Hinsdale. Okay, John, you're on.
Hi, I have diabetes, and I've had it for some time. And, you know, just like daily, I'll get an ad someplace talking about all these cures about, you know, something in your kitchen will cure diabetes. You know, there's all these cures out there, but do they really exist? Do they just mask the symptoms of it? And, you know, I'm on insulin, and You know, basically, I would think that these cures would have to create the pancreas to start working correctly again.
Right.
Isn't that right? So
exactly. So if you
all these cures that people talk about that say that they're going to reduce diabetes or reverse them are really just masking the symptoms.
Well, there is no reversal of diabetes. Okay. Let's get that. Once it occurs. Now, that said. So, this gets back to what we were saying earlier, which is that by the time someone is diagnosed with diabetes, they've lost about between 50 and 70% of the cells that produce insulin. Okay, so you can't get those cells back. Now, what you can do is to lose a dramatic amount of weight, and then the remaining cells might be enough to produce enough insulin that you could go without medication. Okay, that's possible. However, depending upon how long you've had diabetes, the longer you've had it, the less likely that would be to occur. But there's no recreating those islet cells once they're lost. That's why we want to be so, emphatic about preventing diabetes rather than waiting until the horse is out of the barn.
Well, for me, because I am overweight, is that it seems like I hardly ever eat food anymore. When I do, it's healthy food, but it doesn't seem like it affects the weight. The weight stays on anyway.
Right. You'd have to work with a dietitian, and determine your total calories that you're taking in. You know, especially if you don't do much in the way of exercise to burn calories. People can get fairly, it could be like 1,000 or 1,200 calories. You have to go below that in order to begin to lose weight. So it can get to be rather difficult to lose weight over time. Some folks, who are diabetic will, and if they're sufficiently morbidly obese, can get surgery to, gastric bypass or a gastric sleeve can be used to get them off diabetic medications sometimes. However, that is not curing diabetes. That is taking a diabetic on medication and turning them into a diet-controlled diabetic. If that individual were given a glucose tolerance test, you'd see that they don't handle glucose in the same way that they would have handled it 15 or 20 years before.
So I guess the question to you, John, is have you tried the Weight Watchers, which is what I did? It seemed to work really well for me.
I've had a weight problem since I was like 10.
Well, yeah, but you can go online.
I've tried every weight loss center out there. It's just
Go online. Go online to the Weight Watchers. And
right now, I have an endocrinologist and I have a dietitian, and I eat really, really healthy, and I try to eat organic foods. But I don't like now. I'm on Victoza. I have no appetite. So. If I want to eat something, I feel nauseous, and if I don't eat anything, I feel nauseous. So, I mean, it's just, it seems like to me that the insulin is raising up, I'm lowering my metabolism so I don't tend to burn as much as I would like to.
Well, what is true about insulin is that, if your blood sugar is not controlled, you urinate out that sugar. Okay, it goes out in your urine. So you're losing calories through the urine. Insulin tends to stop that process. So whatever you eat gets pumped into the cells of your body. That's what insulin does. It takes sugar in your bloodstream and it pumps it into your cells. So my experience has been that individuals on insulin have a great difficulty losing weight and if many times gain weight in an attempt to control their blood sugars.
John,
that explains it.
Okay,
that
John.
That explains the piece that I ever could understand. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
have a
John.
Great day.
Glad you got some answers. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. We go to Terry in Parksville. Okay, Terry, you're on.
Hi. My name is Tammy, actually,
oh,
not
Tammy.
Terry, but I'm
so
calling.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm calling. I hope I don't lose you here. I'm calling because I'm prone to clotting. I have family history of clots, and I've had a lot of superficial clots in my legs over the years. I'm wondering what I can do besides going on Coumadin. I take a daily baby aspirin every day, I'm looking for natural remedies to help with my clotting of my blood clots.
Sure. Have you seen a hematologist?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I did get tested for factor V.
Right.
And I guess one of my parents had it. My dad had a lot of clots. He's passed away now. Both my parents have passed away.
Right.
And my mother died of clots in her head.
Right.
She had a whole bunch of brain aneurysms.
Right.
So I'm just wondering what I can do. I don't have factor V. My sisters all take aspirin. I do also. They've never had clots, but I've had quite a few.
Well, you know, here's the issue. This is a complex problem. Because there can be many different reasons why people have blood clots.
Okay.
Genetic reasons, in other words, inherited reasons why they have blood clots. People who have inherited problems many times are going to require being on warfarin or Coumadin.
Mm-hmm.
The best person to determine that is a hematologist. Okay. If a hematologist sees you, a hematologist will tell you, well, you can get by on aspirin alone, or no, I think you need to be on warfarin. There is no way of thinning your blood with diet, exercise, or lifestyle for genetic abnormalities of blood clotting.
Okay.
There are things.
You go see a hematologist.
Absolutely, because they'll give you the lowdown on what is the minimum that is going to be safe for you to do. You don't want to, not go to an expert who is going to be looking at all your data and come up with a recommendation. You don't want to go to just anyone and then take it on yourself to say, well, I think I can get by on a baby aspirin. Well, maybe you can't. And, you don't want to end up with a catastrophic blood clot.
Yeah.
You want to get all the information together first and make a decision based on the evidence that's available, with somebody who knows what blood tests to do.
Powerful are those baby aspirins, Paul?
They're powerful. However, there are individuals who may not even require that. So aspirin, even a baby aspirin, has some risk associated with it.
Bleeding.
Bleeding. GI bleeding, hemorrhagic strokes. You could get into a motor
vehicle. What's a hemorrhagic stroke?
You bleed into your brain. You could get into a motor vehicle accident, for example, and you're on aspirin. You'd bleed to death before you get to the hospital, possibly, as opposed to if you weren't taking an aspirin. So the decision to take an aspirin should not be taken lightly, and it should be done. Should be done after you have gathered all the information, discussed it with someone who is an expert, like a hematologist.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I know that I've been taking the aspirin, and I do bruise very easy, and I had traumatic brain injury about 20 years ago in a car accident.
Right.
If I cut myself, I bleed very easy.
Right. You need to talk. You need to talk with a hematologist, ma'am, and I think that would be your best
approach.
Okay. Great to
talk
to you.
Thanks for calling. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's go to Phyllis in NYC. Are you in NYC, Phyllis?
WMAC.
AMC. Yeah, go ahead.
My question has to do with triglycerides and cholesterol.
Okay.
Both my husband and my daughter have triglycerides, and I've never understood the difference. And
well, that's a good question. Basically, what the cholesterol ester, and triglyceride, they're all parts of the particles that make up lipids in your blood. So, for example, you might have you eat some fat, and you eat some carbohydrate. And you're going to get triglyceride and cholesterol absorbed into your bloodstream as a particle called a chylomicron. And that goes to your liver, which then repackages that fat into other types of particles. Okay. When we try to assess the importance of the various components of lipids, which are cholesterol and triglycerides and HDL, We basically don't look at separate particles. We look at the sum total of all the triglycerides. So triglycerides are contained in a bunch of different particles. We look at the total triglyceride load. And triglycerides, the way you should think of them is they're the storage form of fat. So when you have fat stored around your middle, that's a triglyceride storage. It's a glycerol molecule and three fatty acids. And that's the a very efficient way for your body to store energy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When the triglyceride levels in the bloodstream, I'm not talking about in your fat stores, but in the bloodstream go up, okay, you have certain issues that you got too much on board. Many times you're going to have a big belly, but not all the time, but many times you're going to have a bigger belly than you should in order to have it kind of flow out over into your bloodstream, and then your serum triglycerides go up. Now, we know that if the fasting triglyceride level is over 500 milligrams per deciliter, that you're at increased risk for pancreatitis. That's an inflammation of the pancreas, which could kill you.
Would you repeat that one sentence?
When your fasting triglyceride,
uh-huh.
Triglycerides always have to be done fasting to make them compare apples to apples. Your fasting triglycerides are over 500, it increases the risk of pancreatitis, inflammation of the pancreas, which can kill you. So what we want to do is to find out, you know, on a fasting triglyceride level, are they over 500 or not? The second thing, if they're not over 500, triglycerides can still, although this is somewhat more controversial, contribute to other types of cardiovascular risk. And therefore, we tend to want to, and they can actually contribute to changes in the size of LDL particles. The LDL is the bad cholesterol. Too much triglyceride tends to make the LDL particles be packaged into smaller particles, but more numerous ones. And that the consequence of that is that they get into your artery wall more easily. You have to have the bad cholesterol get into your artery wall to set you up for, you know, a heart attack or a stroke. So triglycerides probably do contribute to cardiovascular risk, but it's not exactly clear, you know, what the amount of that contribution is. We still try and get them down as best we can. Is that helpful?
Yes, you said something about the liver, and one of them has low-functioning liver. Is that related to triglycerides, perhaps?
Who has low-functioning liver?
One of the relatives.
One of the relatives?
One of the relatives.
Well, you know, the liver, I mean, the liver has, will package the triglycerides into certain types of particles. So it does contribute to, you know, it's involved in high triglycerides. The liver can also be, in turn, affected by too high a triglyceride in the bloodstream. So the liver can actually become filled with triglyceride, what we call fatty liver. And fatty liver, over a period of time, can actually contribute to cirrhosis of the liver. So it is a important issue to address.
Phyllis, I'm so sorry we got to let you go because there are a lot of people behind
you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's go to number four, who is Frank in Ballston Spa. Frank?
Hi, Alan. Dr. Lemansky, I went through your CardioFit program several years ago.
Right.
And at the time, you recommended one egg, no more than one egg per week, I think it was.
Okay.
Does that still hold or has that changed?
You know, now we're at 1.5 eggs. Well, it depends. That recommendation was probably made on the basis of, because I don't make any limitation of any foods other than to, you know, I mean, usually 2 to 4 eggs a week is average for my patients, okay? So it may have been that we looked at your cholesterol and we said, you know, gee, you know, you're not eating a lot of saturated fat. Maybe dietary cholesterol is contributing to this, and maybe you need to restrict your eggs and see if that has an effect.
Whoa, now what about egg whites?
Egg whites is not an egg.
But
Egg whites, you can eat all the egg whites you want.
You can, only 1 point on the Weight Watchers.
There you go. Alan has become an expert on Weight Watchers, I see.
Indeed.
I've heard that.
But you know, I mean, and again, we could only make a recommendation to you on a theoretical basis, okay?
Yeah, okay.
If you really wanted to know, can I eat 7 eggs a week, you should get your blood done eating 1 egg a week, and then you should go eat 7 eggs a week for about 3 or 4 weeks, and then go get your blood tested again. And if your cholesterol doubles, well, I guess you can't do that.
Yeah, well, my cholesterol is good, so, and I eat about 1 egg a week, maybe a little more.
Egg a week. Wow.
I don't think, again, there is no food that should be limited, but everything should be eaten in moderation. And you know, if you're eating you know, 4 eggs a day, I don't think that's moderate. But again, there are some individuals that can eat 4 eggs a day. Their cholesterol is low. We had a doctor in our practice. She could eat 12 eggs a day, and it wouldn't elevate her cholesterol. It was totally amazing. So, you know, you have to experiment a little bit, and you have to have a doctor that's willing to say, all right, you know, go eat your eggs, and then let's see if it has an effect.
Well, I don't want to eat that many anyway.
Good. I'm glad.
Hey, Frank, you sound like you're doing the right thing. Thanks for calling. Oh, appreciate it.
Okay. Yep. Sure.
And now off to take a break, and then we'll be right back.
Support comes from St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose stmarys.com. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs. Hosting an open house Saturday, April 12th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, adelphi.edu. And Ellis Medicine, providing surgical weight loss options, including gastric bypass, sleeve gastrectomy, and lap band, ellismedicine.org.
And we are back with our great friend, Paul Lemansky. He's done so much for this radio station, so he's been with us, and he's just been terrific. And let's go to Tim in Gilderland, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Tim in Gilderland, your turn.
Doctor, I'm wondering if this comes up in your practice, but my feeling is that it basically you lead a normal life with some modulation of your diet, and you get some decent amount of exercise without being crazy about it, you'll remain healthy. Because I have friends of mine, these two women, and all they do is read diet books. Mm-hmm. And I've watched them at lunch eating a appetizer, entree, 2 glasses of wine, and they're reading a diet book. And then they have dessert. And I think at the point where they get to see you, your patients get to see you, they're way past that. They've led an unhealthy lifestyle, and that's got them to the point where they need medication.
Yeah, I would agree. Unfortunately, this is, you know, part of the problem we have with excess food. I believe you were referring to these two women as going to lunch, were you not?
Yes, I was. Okay. And that doesn't even include dinner. I've seen them at dinner, and they're not going to lose weight.
Right. Well, you know, this is interesting because, I've been approached also. So I was at I can't remember which local place I was at. It was a national chain. I ate something, and then they came up to me and said, I'd just like a cup of coffee. And they said, well, would you like some dessert? And I said, what do you mean? This is lunch. And they're saying, yeah, do you want dessert? I said, well, no, you really shouldn't be eating dessert with lunch. This is where we've gotten in the last 50 years. So 50 years ago, we would have dessert after dinner, okay? Now we're having dessert after lunch. My prediction is if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to have dessert after breakfast.
And, yeah, no, exactly.
You know, this is complete madness, okay?
It's complete madness.
Not realizing the consequences of one's actions and sticking one's head in the sand to try and pretend that there won't be any consequences. You know, some people can get away with it, just like some people can get away with smoking and they die at age 99 when they're hit by a train, you know, but the majority of us are going to have problems, and those problems are going to be related to, you know, behaviors and the actions that we engage in on a daily basis.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I weigh what I weighed in college, and that was 41 years ago.
Well, about 1% of my patient population can say that.
And I eat what I want to eat, but I don't eat. If somebody offers me dessert, I say, like, no thanks, I'm full. I love coffee. I drink coffee. I think coffee is good for you.
Wait. Paul, let's check in on coffee, because I drink too much coffee.
Well, I drink too much coffee, too. No. Mm-hmm. I try to drink a cup or two a day. I used to drink a lot more. There's no evidence, actually, that coffee creates a problem. However, you know, I can't say that I'm completely objective about coffee. So,
well, I followed this research and for about 30 years, and every 6 months there are contradictory studies.
Yeah, yeah.
I think coffee is good for you.
Well, you know, I would argue that half of America, what am I saying? Half. 90% of America starts the day with a cup of coffee. I don't even want to think about what would happen if, you know, all those people suddenly stopped drinking. I think the country would grind to a halt.
Grind is the right word. Hey, Tim, we got to let you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, let's go to Bob in Saratoga. Bob, you're on.
Yes, I have a couple questions. Actually, the coffee thing is kind of interesting because you see commercials with people say it damages your teeth, but that's kind of a small point. What I'm confused about sometimes is I watch public TV, particularly the fundraisers, and they have all these doctors on, and they all have their salvation speech and their own product that they're donating to the station. However, they also have a website, and you can join their club. And it just seems to me that they're all contradictory. There's one, that says fat is your friend.
Well, yeah, I think that's not true. Fat is your friend when you're starving in the middle of a famine. Fat is your friend. I mean, you need fat in order to survive. There's no question about it. Excess fat, on the other hand, is not your friend and will kill you.
Right.
As to whether, you can have unscrupulous practitioners selling a product online,
on public TV, that's the thing.
Well, public TV needs to make money, so believing.
But these guys are making money too.
Well, now wait a minute. Let's not lump us all together here.
No, I mean the guys who are selling their website, and their club.
I understand. You'd have to ask what evidence there was that that particular approach was successful. If they have no evidence, then you don't do it, quite simply.
Of course, they claim evidence. Hey, Bob, thanks for the call and a good point.
Yeah. Yep. We need a meta study.
Yeah. All true.
A meta-analysis, perhaps.
Yeah.
All true. Okay. Let's go to Lisa in Albany. Lisa, you're on.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with colonoscopies, routine colonoscopies.
Right. Sure.
just curious we continue to do the routine colonoscopy as we know it, but there's also the pill camera.
The what?
The pill camera.
That's called a capsule that's called a capsule endoscopy.
You don't hear that much about it anymore. You used to hear a lot more about it.
Yeah. Swallow a camera today. The capsule endoscopy is typically used not to look at the colon, but to look at the small intestine. Mm. So, for example, you can look at the upper gastrointestinal tract, that is the esophagus and the stomach and the duodenum, which is the first portion of the small intestine, with an endoscope, upper endoscopy. You look at the colon, which is the large bowel, with a colonoscopy. But the small intestine in between, and there's 20-some-odd feet of it, you can't image because you can't stick an endoscope up this. It's too far up. You can't navigate the turns. So you'd have to have a colonoscope that was, 40, 50 feet long. I just can't even imagine what something like that would do to the lower bowel, because the torque that would be required to advance the head of the scope would be unbelievably.
What about CAT scan, Paul?
Yeah, you could use a CAT scan, but a better test is the capsule endoscopy, where you actually can it's about the size of a big pill. You swallow. It's got a little camera in it, and it will take pictures of the small intestine as it goes through. But it's not used for a colonoscopy.
But it does get stuck every once in a while, doesn't it?
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah, and so they won't think of doing it as a routine test, right?
Well, how old are you, ma'am?
I'm less than 50, but...
So you're anticipating this colonoscopy, is that it?
Yes, that's it.
At age 50, everybody gets one.
They're not bad. The only thing that's bad about them is the prep for them when you got to drink all that stuff. That's evil.
Evil.
Now, Now, is there the same preparation for the pill camera as well?
Don't know.
I don't know the answer to that question.
But, Paul, most of the cancers are found in the colon, not in the small intestine.
Yes, absolutely. There are very few cancers found in the small intestine, but, you know, there may be angio. So if you have somebody who's an iron deficient, for example, they may have what's called angiodysplasia, little blood vessels that bleed. Sometimes they're going to be in the colon that you can see. Sometimes they're going to be in the small intestine. You want to know where the blood is coming from. That's the capsule endoscopy is a useful test.
Lisa.
Yes. Just one quick thing. Do you have to be in proximity to the hospital when you're doing the pill camera?
No. I think no, because it's going to take some transit time. Okay, it doesn't go through in a few minutes. It takes a while. How often you move your bowels type of thing, you know? It could take a day. So.
Okay.
The capsule endoscopy is not a substitute for a colonoscopy. It's not.
Okay.
And no one in this area would do one, to my knowledge, because you were reluctant to have a colonoscopy. Okay? If you're reluctant to have a colonoscopy, you know, and you're at age 50, you have to look at the family history. That you also have to understand what are the alternatives to colonoscopy. Those would be a barium enema and a flexible sigmoidoscopy, a much shorter tube. Does not require you being knocked out. Doesn't require someone picking you up at the hospital. Some people in the old days, not that long ago, in the 90s, a sigmoidoscopy was considered sufficient because for screening purposes, because, you know, it was most doctors could do it in their office. It was a relatively straightforward procedure. And most colon polyps are going to occur in the lower large intestine, visible to a sigmoidoscope. It's only, you know, after some studies came out showing that going all the way up would pick up the extra few polyps that you would see in the remaining two-thirds of the colon, and therefore it probably was a good idea, if you could, to do a colonoscopy rather than sigmoidoscopy.
Lisa, got to let you go because they want to get everybody in. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's go to Peg in Belchertown. Peg, you're on.
Hi. I've been listening to your program, and I have been told I have a fatty liver. What can I do about that?
Are you overweight?
Yes.
Lose weight.
And that will take care of the fatty liver?
Well, it will help the fatty liver. Whether you can get complete resolution is a different issue. Then you would look at your lipid profile, you know, see if your triglycerides are very elevated. Doing things that will lower your triglycerides may be helpful as well. But the first step, if you're overweight, would be to lose weight. How overweight are you?
Quite a lot.
Okay. Well.
Over 100 pounds.
Well,
I'm a compulsive overeater, and I'm working on that. But you answered my question. Get the weight off, and that will help the fatty liver.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peg. All right.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go to Linda in Saratoga Springs, 1-800-348-2551. Go, Linda.
Hi. My question is about my 29-year-old son. He's a successful kidney transplant recipient for the past 9 years. He got it from his father. He's med compliant. He hasn't had any obstruction, no problems in that time. But I'm wondering, just lately, the past month, he's been having heart palpitations and feeling like he has a irregular heartbeat, and he's got to call into his nephrologist for an appointment. But any thoughts on that in the interim?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that this forum is not the appropriate place to be bringing medical issues like that. So in other words, his primary care doctor should hear about this, not me. His nephrologist should hear about it. His cardiologist, if he has one, should hear about it. You know, and so any new symptom like this in a complex medical patient, a kidney transplant patient is a complex medical patient, should have this evaluated on a prompt basis by people that know them well.
I understand. Sorry to waste your time.
No, it's not a waste of time. We just want to make it clear to our other listeners that, you know, we can't answer all questions on this program in an appropriate fashion. No?
That's okay. Paul, I think you said exactly the right thing. I mean, there's some things that just can't be diagnosed over the air.
You can't. And moreover, you know, in a circumstance like this, you know, this could be a serious issue. It's not something that should be, that we can comment on meaningfully without knowing a lot more information about him.
Sure. Thank you, Paul. And we'll go now to Shirley in Amherst, 1-800-348-2551. Shirley, you're on.
Hello?
Hi, Shirley, you're on.
Oh, I was listening to radio, of course.
Now, you got to turn the radio off. That's rule number one in this whole thing. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Because there's a 7-second delay, and that will confuse things. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I kept checking, but, you know, okay. Yes, I want to know, does caffeine destroy B vitamins? I know that we need niacin for our hair, and I've lost a lot of my hair even though I eat nutritious food and organically grown things. And, you know, I mean...
Not to my knowledge.
Huh?
Not to my knowledge.
But you do raise an interesting question, which I can piggyback on, and that is...
Yeah, it's hard to give up coffee. I don't drink a lot of coffee. I drink tea... But then I drink coffee sometimes.
No, that wasn't the question I was going to ask. I was going to ask about B12. There's been a spate of articles now and some studies which have shown that many Americans, particularly as you get older, are deficient in vitamin B12. What do you do about that, Paul?
Well, first of all, you document it, okay? So B12 deficiency can cause anemia, can cause neurological symptoms, mm-hmm. okay? The typical, neurological symptoms are going to be paresthesias in the hands and feet, that is tingling in the hands and feet.
What about sort of forgetting things?
What's that?
Forgetting
no.
things.
Well, yeah, dementia, reversible causes of dementia, yes. And see, I forgot that. I got to check my B12. and then it also can involve the spinal cord. So that you would not be able to know the position of your feet if it were dark, okay, or the position of your limbs.
What do you mean?
So so typically we know the position of our limbs in part because we get feedback on where they are by looking at them.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But there is a way to do this. If you close your eyes, you should be able to touch your two index fingers together. If you can't do that, your proprioception, your ability of your brain to know the relative positions of both of your hands, or in this, we're talking feet, or your feet, is something that is not dependent only on visual cues, but is dependent on, these small little receptors in your muscles and joints that tell your brain what position the arms and legs are in. So typically, individuals' B12 deficiency will have trouble navigating stairs, for example, when it's dark or diminished light. And so those type of symptoms would lead one to check it, B12, and it's a simple blood test. And then once you determine that there's a deficiency, and there may be different causes for the deficiency to occur, most of them are absorptive causes, problems with absorption of B12, then you need intramuscular B12. So you have to get the B12 into the bloodstream. The easiest way to do that is to put it into the bloodstream directly by putting it into a muscle.
How do you do that? You take drops?
No, you take a shot.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Paul.
Well, I take B-complex, but I was wondering if caffeine destroys the B vitamins.
No, not to my knowledge. At least not to any extent that's clinically meaningful.
Shirley, thank
that's
you.
That's good to know.
Thanks, Shirley. Okay, we'll go to Sarah in Queensbury. Sarah, we got a minute left. Go ahead. You're on.
Okay. I don't know how to pronounce this because I don't have a medical background, but it says the left ventricle size is normal. There is a mild concentric left ventricle hypertrophy.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Okay. So if you think about the heart has different chambers. Okay. Mm-hmm. The left ventricle is the main pumping chamber. The wall of muscle of the left ventricle is the thing that has gotten thicker. Like any muscle in the body, all muscles can get thick if they do more work. So, for example, we see left ventricular hypertrophy occurring in individuals with high blood pressure because the heart has to pump against a higher pressure head. So the free wall of the ventricle has to get thicker to do that more work.
Okay. And Sarah, I am so sorry, but we are out of time.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
I apologize. Okay.
Okay.
We are out of time. We thank our wonderful friend, Paul Lemansky, who's done so much for this station, who's always here for us. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice Physicians, offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. Health-quest.org for locations. Joining us today was Dr. Paul Lemansky, and he's just a great friend. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Toprosyn, creams designed to heal muscle aches, back, neck, and shoulder pain, injuries, carpal tunnel, and more. Toprosyn.com. Thanks again for joining us. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. She's terrific. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update. Thank you, Paul.